Welcome to the Nightly Five podcast with Ben O'Shea.
On today's show, a terror attack at a church in Sydney's West. We speak to an expert on why this shocking incident might be a sign of more to come. Plus, another mushroom poisoning in regional Victoria. I'll get you the latest on that. Outgoing Woolworths CEO Brad Banducci was threatened with jail time by a Senate hearing. And the government is walking away from parts of its much-hyped nature-positive reforms. We'll cross to Canberra for the details. And I'll leave you with more bad news for Bruce Lerman. In our top story today, unpacking the Sydney church terror attack.
Last night, the New South Wales Police overnight declared this a terror incident.
What you just heard is the moment an Orthodox Christian bishop was attacked during a sermon last night at the Assyrian Christ the Good Shepherd Church in Sydney's West, and then Prime Minister Anthony Albanese confirming New South Wales police have called the crime, allegedly committed by a 16-year-old, a terror attack. Here to help us understand is an expert on terrorism and violent extremism from Deakin University, Professor Greg Barton. Professor Barton, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. A pleasure.
And so, can you start by explaining why the church attack last night is an act of terrorism, but not Saturday's mass killing at Bondi Junction?
Well, first thing to say, of course, is that both have ongoing investigations, and just because they start out with a certain framing doesn't mean that's the way it's going to end up. But police have to make a decision. They need to communicate with the public to maintain public trust and understanding, and so they've got to be as transparent as they can. So Saturday they said, we don't see anything about this individual, having identified him, that suggests he's acting as part of a group that believe that the use of violence is going to bring about a political change. And that's the definition of terrorism. Whereas for the 16-year-old knifeman at the church, they identified him and presumably found things in his social media and online postings and footprint and perhaps in his immediate physical social circle that made them believe that he was acting out of a sense that he was going to change the system by using violence. So there is a difference between personal animus and individual acts of hate and acts of violence, which can be, you know, very hateful and awful, but that the individual thinks are somehow justified because they're bringing about political change.
Mm. And the attacker last night at the church in Western Sydney is alleged to have justified his actions by saying he was defending his prophet. What do we know about the potential motivations behind this incident?
Yeah, in isolation, that seems kind of a bit silly because presumably when he said defending his prophet, he thought that he was somehow defending Islam and the Prophet Muhammad by going in and attacking a Christian bishop. And that seems like a long bow, like, you know, why would you even think that what somebody in a different community is saying is somehow your responsibility to respond to? But if we understand this is an Assyrian church, the Assyrian ethnic community, which was a small minority in Iraq, but also parts of northeastern Syria. And in northwestern Iraq and northeastern Syria, this was the area that was taken over by Islamic State for their caliphate. And so from a community that was just 3% of the Iraqi population, 40% of the Iraqi refugees who fled Islamic State violence were from the Assyrian community. And in Australia, the Assyrian community is perhaps as large as 60,000 people. So that gives it a particular context. It suggests that this 16-year-old thought that he was acting in the name of a group perhaps like Islamic State, perhaps linked to Islamic State, and that this was an appropriate target, appropriate act of violence, because he was fixated on the idea that somehow this would lead to larger things, to social change. So not just a hate crime, but something more, which is why police are saying, well, that fits the definition of terrorism. We're looking for the larger pattern. We're looking to see who his social network was, and to what extent maybe they're an ongoing threat, but in any case, what's going on there? The fact that you had an angry crowd response, which in itself was a terrible development, was probably what the knife man and the people in his social network intended, and that sort of adds to the awfulness of it, because indeed this is a community with lots of trauma and tensions, and so more easily provoked than most. And that's exactly what we should be paying attention to in terms of trying to keep everyone safe.
Mm. ASIO boss Mike Burgess has said today that the incident last night fit the profile that he warned us about in 2022, the idea of a lone wolf actor. How hard is it to stop these kinds of attacks, and how prepared are local authorities when something like this unfolds in the suburbs?
Well, lone actor, I mean, it's probably better to say lone actor than lone wolf, because lone wolf was the term that the original terrorists, the anarchists, you know, going back more than 120 years ago, used to describe themselves. They thought it was an act of heroism to launch into an act of violence. But lone actors are really hard to see coming and hard to prevent. A classic example was the Australian terrorist who shot dead 51 people in prayer in Christchurch in March 2019. Terrible cold-blooded violence. And we're still asking the question, what could have been done to see this guy transitioning from a guy who posted hateful stuff to a guy who would pick up AR-15s and launch a murderous attack? Very hard to spot. And in the case of Christchurch, the availability of those weapons led to a terrible attack. But even if you do all the sensible things for limiting access to weapons, pretty much anyone can go out and rent a heavy vehicle or just go to the kitchen drawer and pull out a knife and go to a public space. And you can't do everything to eliminate that threat. You can train people at shopping malls to respond to a lone gunman or a lone knife attacker, which is what happened at Bondi Junction. They responded with, you know, great bravery and doing exactly the right things, as did the parishioners at the church last night. They lunged forward and probably saved the lives of the bishop and the priest. But could they have seen that lone actor coming through the door? Probably not. Maybe there's a lesson there about perimeter security. When you're doing a live streaming service for a sensitive community, perhaps taking attention to make sure you've got security on your doors and people just can't run through the building with a knife. There's some things you can do better. But yeah, the reason Mike Burgess speaks about the great fear of lone actor attacks is they're so hard to foresee and so hard to stop.
Mm. And I think then the talk turns pretty naturally to social media, where some of these lone actors are quietly radicalised, potentially, you know, in the bedrooms of their parents' homes. The eSafety Commissioner last month issued legal notices to the big tech companies like Google and Meta and X, formerly Twitter, and Telegram and Reddit, requiring each company to report on the steps they're taking to protect Australians from violent extremist material. Are the big tech platforms doing enough?
Long story short, no, they're not. The big tech platforms are very reluctant to spend their own money when they don't have to, or to, you know, link to this, eat into their business model by, you know, the clickbait model of promoting more and more extreme material so people keep responding. They don't want to stop doing that, and they will only stop or do it less to the extent they're forced. The European Union, European Parliament's taking strong measures. They've got an easier run in other countries. Australia's, you know, stepping up on this. That's part of the solution, and it's fair enough to criticise the big tech players. But there's a bigger problem than just that. You know, it is part of what we need to be paying attention to.
Mm. And I think the final question I'll ask you is, now that this incident has happened, Australia has been very fortunate to not have experienced some of this type of violence that we've seen around the world all too often. Does last night's incident make it more or less likely that there'll be another incident? Or is it just, you know, impossible to predict?
It's certainly possible to predict. And if you know, if your job is to work in this area of intelligence and security, then you've got to take it seriously and say, even the Bondi Junction knife attack, although it wasn't terrorism motivation, operates as a kind of a example to some people, perhaps to inspire them. They could do so much damage so easily that there are these soft targets. So the copycat phenomenon is a real worry. And now we've had another knife incident, this time actually linked with terrorism, and it provoked a really angry response from a traumatized community. That actually does increase the likelihood that somebody else will try and do this again. The flip side is it gives us a chance to learn and be better prepared and to double down our efforts to you know, educate people not to respond in anger and to be prepared to do the right thing. I think we saw some wonderful scenes in Bondi Junction in the middle of a horrible event on Saturday, where people working in the shops ordinary shoppers responded with bravery and with, you know, insight to keep people safe, to go out and help people where they could. You know, we have the brave French guy on the escalator with a bollard. We also have the only man who was killed was a Pakistani Muslim refugee, new on the job as a security guard, and the reason he lost his life because he stepped forward trying to do the right thing. So don't want people to lose their lives, but certainly putting people in safe places in the shops and responding quickly, that's the response of training and preparation. In you can't predict the lone actor attack, but you can prepare for how you respond. I think perhaps after last night, churches are going to have to be a little bit more, churches and other places of worship, a little bit more thoughtful about security, just because in the world we live in, there will be people who will try and exploit what they see as being soft targets.
Yeah, I think that's the sad reality. From Deakin University, Professor Greg Barton, thanks for sharing these insights on The Nightly Five.
A pleasure. Thanks very much. Cheers.
A woman is dead and two others are in hospital after allegedly consuming a drink at a health retreat in the regional town of Clunes.
Yes, this may sound too bizarre to be true, but we're hearing reports of another case of mushroom-related death in regional Victoria. Online editor David Johns has joined me in the studio. Johnsy, what can you tell us?
Look, it's early days at this stage, but a woman has sadly lost her life. 53-year-old Ringwood woman died on Saturday after becoming ill at a health retreat at a place called Clunes. It's near Ballarat in Victoria. Obviously, Ballarat's had a pretty troubled past, recent past anyway, with two women being murdered in the last few months. The death reportedly occurred at this place called Solbarn. So it is a health retreat, and investigators haven't ruled out the possibility that the drink that this woman consumed before dying could have involved mushrooms of some sort.
Yeah, right. And this is obviously something that has immediately hit the headlines because we know about Erin Patterson, the woman in regional Victoria, and Leon Gatha, who is at the centre of an alleged mushroom lunch, a beef Wellington laced with poisonous mushrooms that has left three people dead and a fourth fighting for his life. And she's now facing murder charges, and that'll come before the courts this year. So anything involving mushrooms and poisoning is something that we pay attention to. I guess police are now investigating this incident and asking for anyone with information to call Crime Stoppers.
They are, yeah. The local crime investigation unit detectives are on the case, but the police spokesman said that they will be filing a report for the coroner. So we'll see where they go from here.
Yeah, and, you know, not to make light of it, but at the time of the Leon Gatha poisoning, the mushroom industry of Australia talked about how big a hit they had received to their business because, you know, these are a very specific type of poisonous mushroom, very different to what you get in the supermarkets, of course, but people, I guess, just get turned off mushrooms. And so you can imagine this latest one is just another blow to the mushroom industry. But we'll wait to find out more before we jump to any conclusions. Online editor David Johns, thanks for joining us with this update.
Thanks very much.
Our government is getting on with our goal of delivering a nature-positive Australia. A nature-positive Australia, which means protecting more of our natural environment for our kids and our grandkids to enjoy. Protecting more of what's precious, repairing more of what's damaged, and managing nature better for the future.
That was Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek last year speaking with hope and optimism about her government's nature-positive laws. Well, what a difference a few months makes. Federal politics reporter Dan Jervis-Bardi is on the line. Dan, you can reveal Plibersek is going to put some of the nature-positive plan on the back burner.
That's correct. So when the minister was speaking last year with the optimism you described, the intention was to push ahead with a really wide and significant package of environmental law reforms. Now, what's happened in the month since and what she announced today is that rather than pushing ahead with one large chunk of legislation, she's going to carve it up. And essentially what that means is they're going to sort of put the most contentious parts on the back burner. And which sort of means it remains to be seen whether they will actually happen, but they are going to push ahead with one important component, and that's to create a new federal environment protection agency. But long story short, the hopes of having this really grand, significant reform done as one is over, and they've made a decision to split things up, and I guess we'll see what happens from here.
And is the thinking behind the carve-up just a case of the federal government just looking for some easier wins?
Well, the minister was, her official response is that this is a very significant piece of legislation. I think the bill itself will run into the, be more than 1,000 pages. So their line is that, it's important to take time to get this right. Now, clearly what has happened in the months after you played that clip of the minister talking about the need to get on with the job, there's been a very significant backlash from the mining industry in particular to some of the proposals that were put out there. And I think the minister and the government generally is clearly feeling the pressure, has sort of read the tea leaves and decided to slow things down a little bit. And the decision to split things up and do it piece by piece is a product of that.
Yeah, right. And so what do you think this means as far as the total reform package goes ahead of the next election?
It's a great question. So I think the prospects, trying to guess anything in federal politics is a mug's game, but I think if I was to guess, I think the likelihood that the whole package is passed before the next election is slim to none. I think, the minister intends or will introduce legislation to create the new federal EPA within weeks. Now, anyone that follows these things, the bill will be introduced, but then there'll be an inquiry. There'll likely be a fight in the Senate with the Greens and the Coalition. If the government comes through that unscathed and get it passed, I think the likelihood of them wanting to go back and do that all again with a more contentious piece of legislation, at that point it'll be very close to an election. I doubt there'll be much appetite. So you never know. Things can change quickly in this place. But as I'm sitting here right now, I highly doubt that the entire package will be passed before the next election.
Yeah, I think you might be pretty spot on then. And if they can get a new EPA up and through Parliament, well, I think they'd take the W on that. At least it's something they could take to the next election and say something came out of the nature positive reforms. We'll see how it ends up. Federal politics reporter Dan Jervis-Bardy, always appreciate your time on the Nightly Five.
Thank you very much.
Why won't you confirm what your ROE was?
Senator, with due respect, we focus on our return on investment.
All right, I know what you focus on. Thank you, Mr. Banducci. I know what you focus on. I feel compelled to advise you that it is open to the Senate to hold a witness in contempt when they refuse to answer a legitimate question.
I've answered the question many times.
You have not answered the question, Mr. Banducci. Honestly, I'm not interested in your spin or your bullshit. This is a Senate inquiry. Answer the question.
That's Green Senator and Committee Chair Nick McKim in the Senate Committee into Supermarket Pricing, threatening to hold outgoing Woolworths CEO Brad Banducci in contempt. Now, you all remember Banducci. He's the bloke who fell on his sword after this spectacular implosion on the ABC Four Corners show.
Can we take that out? Is that okay? He is retired, but I shouldn't have said that, Angus. Are we going to leave it in there if we are?
Well, if we're on the record. You said it. Let's move on. But
I think I'm done, guys. I do this with good intent. I don't do this with bad intent.
You're walking out, really?
No. Can we just talk to Brad for a second?
Let me just
have a minute.
An attempted walkout on Four Corners is just embarrassing. Dodging Senate questions is another thing entirely. Being held in contempt can result in jail time and fines, and the threat came amid hostile and ugly questioning today at the Senate inquiry. Senator McKim accused Banducci of kind of bullshitting his way through and asked if he was struggling with the ordinary English language. Banducci was asking for trouble when he said he did not know what Woolworths' return on equity was in the 2023 financial year and would take the question on notice. He also said Woolworths did not accept accusations of price gouging customers and said its goal was to help them. Banducci also pushed back on suggestions that Woolworths buys up independent supermarkets to reduce competition. He said there was only one incidence of that happening in the past 5 years in the ACT. However, Banducci did acknowledge Australians were experiencing tough demands on their wallet during periods of high inflation, but said grocery prices were beginning to taper. He said 60% of overall grocery inflation had been driven by Woolworths' top 100 suppliers. That last bit was a good example of playing the blame game, but let's be honest, that's exactly what this Senate inquiry is all about.
The chance discovery of a banned document in the jury room forced the judge to abruptly end the trial before they could reach a verdict on whether Miss Higgins was raped inside Parliament House.
Former Liberal staffer Bruce Lerman has consistently denied allegations that he raped Brittany Higgins, a colleague and fellow political staffer in the Parliament office of then Defence Industry Minister Linda Reynolds in March 2019. In a criminal trial in 2022, he pleaded not guilty to one charge of sexual intercourse without consent, denying that any sexual activity had occurred. That trial was declared aborted when a juror brought outside material into the jury room. The case was then dropped after the Director of Public Prosecutions found continuing it posed an unacceptable risk to Higgins' health and well-being. On the basis of all of that, notorious men's rights activist Bettina Arndt, who founded Mothers of Sons and Australians for Science and Freedom, thought Lerman would be the perfect keynote speaker at the group's controversial symposium, Restoring the Presumption of Innocence. Lerman was due to speak at the conference in June, and then, of course, this happened yesterday.
Mr. Lerman raped Miss Higgins.
Lerman displayed a breathtaking lack of self-awareness when he launched the defamation case against Network 10 for airing allegations that Justice Lee eventually decided were more likely than not to be true. But Lerman showed he does possess an iota of self-awareness today when he withdrew from speaking at the Presumption of Innocence event. Funny that. And that, folks, is today's show. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and join me tomorrow on The Nightly Five.
The Nightly Five podcast is brought to you by Seven West Media. For all these stories and more, head to thenightly.com.au, helping you get in front of tomorrow.